Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at betterleadersbetterschools.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. This podcast is also a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. I created Better Leaders, Better Schools because I was fed up of not having deep conversations, vulnerable, authentic conversations about school leadership. And that's why you keep coming back week after week. You listen to this podcast as an investment in your own leadership development. If you would like to invest in the production of Better Leaders, Better Schools, I have really good news. It's extremely affordable. $1 or $2 a month will go very far and make a big impact. At $10 a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every 60 days. To become a patron, it's easy. Just click the link in the show notes, become a patron. Thank you for investing in yourself and thank you for investing in this podcast. Thank you for listening every week. Let's get this show started.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
Different projects demand different amounts of time. What's important is not how long the project is, but that it has what we called sustained inquiry. So we created a new element in the project design called sustained inquiry and tried to describe why that was important.
Ladies and gents, may I introduce to you John Mergendahler.
Hello, everybody, and Daniel, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for asking me.
Absolutely. As I was sharing with you, John, in the email and in our pre-chat before we went live with this podcast, fascinated by your work, a colleague shared an article with me called Why We Changed Our Model of the 8 Essential Elements of PBL. And for our listeners, that's problem-based learning. And we are in the midst of trying to roll this out at our school. And we want to do it in a smart way, pilot it first before going school-wide. And this is sort of a dream interview for me. You're the expert on problem-based learning, and I want to go to the source. How do we do it? So this article, like I said, John, was fascinating. And I'm wondering, can you unpack a little bit this new model for the gold standard, you call it, of problem-based learning?
I'll do my best, Daniel. I want to first just comment on project and problem-based learning because the words sometimes confuse people, and we actually think they're more or less interchangeable. We prefer project-based learning and think of it as the bigger category of which problem-based learning fits within. But in some ways, that's just sort of academic irrelevance, because what both of those models are seeking to do is deeply engage students, give them something meaningful and authentic to think about and delve into, and provide an opportunity for them to demonstrate what they have learned through their performance, not through more traditional means. So when we think about project-based learning, we divide it into what the teacher does and the way the project is created. And we distinguish between design elements, which is how a project is put together, and teaching practices, which is what the teacher does once the project is underway. There is some confusion out there with regards to the role of the teacher. In part, that's because so much attention has been paid to student learning that the teacher has been somewhat ignored in the writing and the research about project-based learning. But the teacher is absolutely crucial. You can't have a good project without scaffolding, monitoring, managing, culture building by the teacher. So when we rethought our model of project-based learning, we wanted to bring front and center the importance and the role of the teacher. And that's why we write about project-based teaching practices as well as project-based design elements. Now, I don't know if it would be helpful for me to talk about the individual elements within each of our conceptualizations, or talk more generally about project-based learning? Could you give me a little guidance here?
Absolutely. I'd love to dig into the components of your redesign. And I apologize for saying problem-based when I meant to say project-based earlier. I'll attribute that to nerves. But before we even go there, though, can you explain a little bit and dig into the role of the teacher? That's fascinating to me.
Sure. Well, let's back up and think about the role of the teacher in general to begin with. And, you know, the teacher is the gatekeeper for content. Teacher has to decide what's most important for students to learn, to ask themselves the question, what would I be really embarrassed about if kids left my class unable to do something? Establish priorities and think about what really is the most important thing to use the most precious resource, which is classroom time, to focus on. So the first part of the teacher's role is to design and plan a project that focuses on important and significant content, and what we call key knowledge, understanding, and success skills. Other people call success skills 21st century skills or skills needed for workplace success, soft skills. They are the problem-solving, critical thinking, communication, collaboration, the 4C skills that people have been talking about probably for the last 5 or 6 years. So a teacher begins in selecting or creating a project. Not all projects have to be built from scratch. There are a lot of wonderful projects out there. There's some on our site. There's some on other people's sites. You can go to pbl.org and find some interesting ones. But seeing it on paper is very different than thinking about how it's going to roll out over several days or a week or 3 weeks or a semester. So there's a good deal of thought that needs to go into just the pacing, the benchmarks that are going to be established, the design of the project as a whole. At the same time, and I've been emphasizing how it's important to focus on significant content or key understandings, it's important to take a look at standards. These may be formal standards. They may be more informal school emphasized standards. But again, going back to those things that you'd feel really bad about if your students left the class and they couldn't do it. And make sure that a project focuses on something that is worthwhile to learn. You're going to be spending significant time on it, and it ought to have significant content behind it. Another thing the teacher does to ensure that project-based learning will go off successfully in the class is to build a culture in which collaboration, communication among students, a sense of teamwork, and a willingness to have fun and to think outside the box, that culture is going to support the instructional aspects and the learning aspects that are in the class. And this is something that should start from the day that the first day of the semester and continue right on through, respecting students, giving them firm guidelines about what is appropriate and inappropriate behavior, encouraging and rewarding the support that students give each other, asking students questions and really listening to their answers, wanting to hear their answers, wanting to know what they think about things. All of these things help teachers to build a culture in which project-based learning can be successful. There are also other traditional teacher roles that are important. What has been somewhat dismissed, I would say, is classroom management. Classroom management is key. There are times when things have to be reined in, and there are times when things have to be encouraged to go forward and loosened up a bit. There are ways in which students address each other and address the teacher, and there are things that have to be handed in on time and handed back and all of these things. So management doesn't go away just because you're doing a project. It's more of a collaborative management, an encouraging management, a management which expects student success, but it's management all the same. The next thing a teacher does is to scaffold student learning. There have been several articles written about project-based learning in which students are sort of given a task and left alone. And typically they don't do terribly well with it because the teacher hasn't set up the scaffolds that they need to be successful. And sometimes these scaffolds have to do with language. If you have a class that has a lot of non-native speakers in it, sometimes it has to do with the skills they're going to need for the project, learning how to conduct telephone interviews or read laboratory instruments. But whatever it is, thinking through what's going to get in the way of student success and then thinking further about what are the scaffolds that can be put in place or applied at the time of the project, that's key. Finally, the teacher takes an ongoing role as a coach. And this has been probably written about more than anything else, the guide on the side, the sage on the stage. We think coach is the best metaphor, because if you think about a sports team in which the role of the coach is to make sure that each player is contributing to the team, that is the class, and is building the skills to be successful and is encouraged to go out there and do their best. And I think that's a perfect definition of what teaching is. So we've named these seven elements as project-based teaching practices. One could argue about some of them. We argued quite a bit in writing the Setting the Standard book. In fact, we went through 44 different variations of these conceptualizations until we finally stopped. And we might have gone through a 45th if we hadn't had an editorial deadline. But we think that these do a pretty good job of calling out the key skills that a teacher uses during a project to encourage students to be successful. Let me hold it there.
Sounds good to me, and I appreciate what you shared there. You're talking about the culture creation, which I think our listeners are definitely extremely interested in, and thank you for sharing some tips on how to build that culture of collaboration, of taking risks, and having outside-the-box thinking, scaffolding the instruction to meet your students exactly where they're at. And you pose some really interesting questions, too, that educators need to ask themselves, so that it's not just teaching what you're comfortable and teaching what you're used to, but teaching what your kids actually need. And then the metaphor of the teacher as a coach, which I also agree is a perfect metaphor in terms of the encouraging role. I like what you said in terms of getting all the players, all the students to contribute to the team within the classroom. And a little bit of a side question here is, do you have a favorite sports team or a favorite coach?
I'm a soccer fan, but usually only every 4 years during the World Cup.
Gotcha. So then you take a little bit of sabbatical for a while and go all in.
Yeah.
That's probably a healthy way to do it. So why the redesign of the project-based learning model?
Well, in 2003, we published the first project-based learning handbook. And sometime after that, I think maybe about 2005, we came up with the eight essential elements. And that has really been the basis of our professional development work, of our writing. And people have found them, you know, quite useful. There's a simple way to think about project-based learning. But people also had many suggestions to make. Currently, the Buck Institute works with about 15,000 teachers face-to-face a year. And you can bet about 14,099 have something to say about our professional development, generally positive, but often some challenging questions. And we wanted to model being learners and learn from our experience working with teachers. Although our professional development staff, most of them are currently in the classroom as teachers, everyone faces different contexts and contingencies, and we just felt it was time to step back and do two things: to look at the advice and questions and suggestions that we've received over the past 10 years or so, and then also to look at the research. And one of the most important aspects of the book is to review what research has said leads to student learning and classroom success. And so we did that. We went back and looked at about 20 years of research in project and problem-based learning and used these findings to hone our own thinking in what was important. For example, it wasn't until I went back and read the literature on formative assessment that we realized how crucial this was and how we needed to call this out. I mean, we'd always talked about assessment, but we hadn't emphasized it quite as much. So that became one of our emphases. In terms of, I haven't talked about the design elements, but authenticity was one that we called out in this revision. Again, we'd always talked about authentic projects, but we hadn't sort of given it its own little triangle in our diagrams. So we wanted to make sure that the model we were promulgating was one which was research-based and was also, it had iterated one time and taken advantage of other people's learning as well as our own.
Yes, and I think that's a huge leadership insight that principals can take to heart, would be to respond to the advice, the questions, the feedback that your staff has. So in your case, it was the practitioners on the front lines trying to figure out what project-based learning meant day to day, and they would give you that type of feedback. But then also not to ignore the research too, which showed, you know, what are the best practices and what has the most impact. And if I'm hearing you correctly, that led to the revision of your project-based learning model.
That's correct. And I mean, there was also a bit of serendipity in that ASCD asked us to do this book and thought, oh my gosh, if we're going to do an ASCD book, we want to make sure that it's a valid description of what really of good project-based learning. So that sort of sent us back to make sure that we didn't just put a lot of hot air in there. And
it was practical stuff that you could actually use.
Right.
John, I just want to clarify for the listeners, the text that you're talking about, is that setting the standard for project-based learning?
That is correct.
Okay, so we'll absolutely have that linked up for all the listeners of the show. It's a go-to resource for project-based learning, and the subtitle is A Proven Approach to Rigorous Classroom Instruction. And if you've been listening to the last few minutes, you know that John has revised the model because teachers, practitioners gave their real-time feedback and also adjusted the model based on the research. So when he says it's a proven approach, it is. You could take that to the bank if you're interested in rolling out project-based learning at your school. John, were there any shifts in the model that were unexpected or delighted you in a certain way just because you hadn't seen it before and now it was new and it's just so exciting for you?
That's a good question. I will answer it. I want to first say, though, that the changes in the model are more of emphases and clarifications than they are brand new elements. So I think what surprised me was realizing that things that we took for granted, we had not been clear enough in describing project-based learning. And to give you an example of that, one of the questions that we often get in, or got, I guess, past tense here, in our professional development was, how long is a project? Well, in our minds, a project had to be long enough so that there was an opportunity to build in critique and revision, and for students to set goals and meet them, and for a significant, worthwhile piece of work to be done. Now, that doesn't mean every project begins 3 weeks long. In fact, we encourage teachers to start very simple and very small and get bigger as they go along and learn from the experience. But if we're thinking about a definitional project, it's got to be long enough that kids can persevere and create something worthwhile. But we hadn't really called that out. We didn't have, it's ridiculous to say a project has to be 3 days or 5 days or 10 days, because, you know, there may be school assemblies and all sorts of practical things that get in the way. And also, different projects demand different amounts of time. What's important is not how long the project is, but that it has what we called sustained inquiry. So we created a new element in the project design called sustained inquiry and tried to describe why that was important. And instead of answering the question, how long should a project be, we would turn the question around and say, well, given the key knowledge, understandings, and success skills that you want the project, that you want students to learn by completing the project, how long is that going to take? What will it need for students in terms of time for students to have inquiry into the question and to be able to sustain their work and create a product which is worthwhile? And then it becomes the question, that a teacher answers trying to meet the goal of providing students with the experience of sustained inquiry as opposed to simply meeting some arbitrary standard of a certain number of days or contact hours or something like that. Similarly, critique and revision, we've always encouraged teachers to use critique and revision, but we didn't call it out again with as much emphasis as we do in our new writing, and pointing out that if there is a secret sauce to project-based learning, and I don't think there is, there may be sauces, but this is one of the ingredients to that sauce, or one of the sauces, that students learning how to critique their own work and that of others in a caring, humane, and useful way is an important skill that will not only benefit them in terms of the project, it's going to benefit them in the future, and that there should be an opportunity in the project for some critique and revision so that students can get better at what they're doing and can learn to recognize the criteria of quality in what they're doing. So I hope that, you know, gives a sense of it's not so much that this is a, you know, and now we, shazam, we have a new definition. It's that I think we've been a little more helpful, I hope we've been a little more helpful, in describing our own ideas, the research-supported findings, and then the experience of the teachers we worked with in telling us what excellent project-based learning was.
Yeah, and again, you know, we shared that already with the leaders, but that's that leadership insight of being responsive to your people. But another one that I really appreciate with you pulling back the curtains and talking about the creative and iterative process of redesigning your model for gold standard project-based learning, just the openness, not having things set in stone, responding to feedback, and being uncomfortable, I guess, in maybe the messiness of it, right? So we're always working towards greater clarity, and your text does that. Your new model does that based on the feedback you received. But you're going to have an idea. You're going to know where you want to go. You know the destination, but you're so wise. You can't say that project takes 3 days to get there, 5 days to get there. You got to have some room to breathe, some space for people to make mistakes and then revise, I guess, their path of how they're going to achieve whatever that project is. And then making it happen. So do you have any insights on principals, on educators that are a little bit uncomfortable with that messiness is how I define it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we think the school leader, the principal, and to some degree, the superintendent is key to making project-based learning a success. Because these folks, they control the way time is used in the school. They establish and encourage and sanction certain types of behavior. They can be very instrumental in creating norms of collaboration and teamwork. They allow teachers to spend time together and plan and learn from each other and develop new assessment methods. So leadership, we think, is a key support for teachers in doing project-based learning. It's pretty tough to do project-based learning by yourself with no supportive colleagues in a 45-minute middle school classroom. It's much easier if you have more time, if you have time to plan, if students, when they come together, expect that they're going to be helping each other instead of trying to do better than each other. So principals are key. One of the things that I would encourage principals to read and think about is not actually a leadership book, but it's a book about student work, and it's called The Culture of Critique, or A Culture of Critique. It's written by Ron Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R. Ron is one of the leaders, I would say saints, of the project-based learning movement, and it's a very thoughtful look at what it requires to get high-quality student work. And that's, of course, what principals want. They want their kids to learn. They want them to do good work. And they want them to get good test scores. And they want them to be good people. And all of these things are linked together. So it's not, first of all, the first thing I would say to a principal is, can you be supportive? Can you help a teacher reach these goals? Do these goals match what you were looking for in your own students? Is this, these goals match what you want for your school? And then accept first some baby steps on the part of a teacher. You know, let's try something very simple. Let's try a 3-day project with very limited goals, but very tight assessment. Don't give the students a lot of freedom at this point. Have it fairly structured. See how it goes. See how it happens. Have some opportunity for teachers to talk about their experience afterwards. Have them engage in their own critique about what they did and how it worked. See how, as a principal, you feel about that. My hunch is that most principals will be incredibly energized by this, you know, small dose of project-based learning and will want to see more of it.
That is great advice, and I really appreciate you bringing up the questions a principal and even a superintendent should be asking. Really, how does the structure of our schools, how do the systems that we have set up support our initiatives, our goals, or how do they act as obstacles and challenges? I think that's something that I see even in my own school as we're looking at trying to do more project-based learning, as we are looking at standards-based grading. Do the systems actually support it? And on some level, right now, I have to say no, right? I work in Chicago Public Schools. The grade book that we have is set up. It's, you know, extremely traditional in terms of reporting the grades. But we're asking the teachers to change how they've been doing things. And there's been a lot of conflict and friction within that. And that's because of that question. Does the system that we have set up, does the structure that we have set up support what we're asking our people to do? And you can't get past that. I also really appreciate the idea and really giving leaders permission. Start small. You don't have to go big right away. And it's actually crazy to do that. Jim Collins says it best. He says to shoot bullets before cannonballs. And that's just the idea of piloting things to learn what are the strengths, what are the challenges, what are the obstacles. And like you did with your gold standard of project-based learning, then making tweaks and iterations to improve upon the model. So thank you so much for those really great insights. John, can we shift gears a little bit and tell me just what inspired you to pursue a career in education?
I was a draft dodger, and that is I graduated from college during the Vietnam War, and I had filed a conscientious objector statement, but I was worried that it wouldn't be accepted and I'd be faced with going to Vietnam or going to prison. And I didn't see any value in going to prison, and it also scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
And I had always admired my teachers. I enjoyed school. I'd done relatively well, although I was never, you know, the top of the class. And I thought, well, why don't you try teaching? Because at that point, teaching was deferred. That is, you could maintain deferment and not be eligible for the draft.
Gotcha.
And I started teaching English, and I loved it. And I thought, this is really exciting and interesting, and I love the kids. And the second year, I said, you know, I guess I found what I want to do. So I continued teaching English for a while, and then I thought, well, this is a lot of fun. I bet running schools would be great. And I went to graduate school, and I took this great course taught by Mark Shedd, who had been the superintendent of Philadelphia. It was very informal, and he sort of just talked about the superintendent's year. I mean, what are union negotiations like, and how do you select principals, and, you know, this sort of thing. And about 6 weeks into the class, I thought, I got to be crazy. I couldn't do that. That's a terrible job.
It's a terrible job.
For me. I mean, you know, there's different people have different strengths and different things that allow them to succeed. And I just didn't have the skill set, I guess we would say today. Then we probably would have said I wasn't cut out for being a school administrator, as much as I admired them and knew how important they were. So I took another path. I went to, instead of going on in getting an EdD in school leadership, I went on in research and wound up doing graduate work and getting a PhD in education and psychology, and then worked in educational research and professional development from then on.
Wow, and I appreciate your transparency and honesty in what, you know, how you found your career in education. And one of the key takeaways there is make sure you know what you're cut out for.
Yeah.
At your core, who are you, right?
Right.
It's great for school leaders, for researchers, for all human beings to establish sort of their values, their personal values, and then understanding how does this work? How does this career support or challenge my own personal values? And you found out and found a course and path that was cut out for you, and you've made a huge impact. And I appreciate and admire your work.
And let's pause here for a message from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at betterleadersbetterschools.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. You know, I'm just like you. I'm a school leader that wants to get better every single day, and that's why I created a free gift for you called The 15 Questions to Unlock Your Leadership Potential. You can grab it today for free by texting the word UNLOCK NOW to 33444. That's UNLOCK NOW to 33444, and The 15 Questions to Unlock Your Leadership Potential will be delivered straight to your inbox. And now back to our show.
You've been with the Buck Institute for a while too, serving as the executive director. This project-based learning, where was the seed planted? Was this something you experienced as an English teacher back then? Was this during your graduate studies? Where did this start?
I think it was post all that. I think it was a confluence of two things. I'd been at the Far West Laboratory working on science education and school reform, and I went to the Buck Institute. And there was a lot of interest in project-based learning in Marin County, where we were located. And there were several schools that were trying different things. And there was a project that started then that's still going on in stream reclamation and environment. And so it was sort of in the air here. It was very, very interesting. And we did a little research, and one of the things that struck us was the variability in the quality of what students did. I mean, there was some classrooms and teachers where the kids were just doing extraordinary work. You know, they were writing articles for, you know, we had fifth graders writing newspaper articles are being published in the Chronicle, and just acting in the real world about important things and making contributions and feeling good about themselves. And it was marvelous. And then we had classrooms where kids were just sort of wasting their time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of activity, but no learning. And sometimes kids were enjoying it, and sometimes they were bored stiff. And so we asked ourselves, what could we do to try and take the lessons from those classrooms where kids were really succeeding and package them in some way, both in books and in professional development, so that teachers could be more successful in doing project-based learning? And then it just sort of snowballed. We started publishing books. If you go to the BIE.org website, you'll see the books that we've written about project-based learning. We started doing professional development. At the same time, No Child Left Behind kicked in, and for a while it looked like that was the end of project-based learning. But what happened was there was a reaction to No Child Left Behind.
Yeah.
And people started saying, there's got to be more to education than this.
Mm-hmm.
This drill and kill is not what I want for my kids. And if I'm a parent, that's not what I want my kids to do. And so this alternative movement started around project-based learning. At the same time, the business community started becoming very upset with the quality of the graduates who were coming out of high schools because they couldn't work with each other. And the business community had made the shift. Now you're not an employee. You're a team member. You're on a team. Your team is given a project. And they found that, you know, they had to teach students how to do projects. And they thought this was something the schools ought to be doing, that these skills of critical thinking and collaboration and setting goals and monitoring progress, you know, asking questions, these are things that they wanted their new employees to be able to do. So a number of, you know, forces came together at the same time, and through a combination of hard work and luck, we just happened to be a little bit ahead of the wave and, you know, paddling like hell to try and stay there and produce things and create quality experiences for teachers.
Well, that's incredible. John, during your work, based on your schedule, I think one thing that I really like to explore with all my guests is just how you stay on track, right? So how is it that you avoid distractions and stay focused at work? What is it that you do?
You know, I don't have any secret sauce on this except the practical ones of staff meetings that are worth spending time in and a set of weekly and monthly priorities I set for myself and, you know, calendars. And you get to a point where you write the email that's two words rather than two paragraphs, and you just figure out what is worth spending time on and, you know, what can I get by with just to get it off my desk. And sometimes that can seem a little harsh. I certainly don't mean it harsh, but as everyone knows, there's only so many hours in the day, and there are a lot of important things that need to be accomplished. So if you can be economical and spend as little time as possible on things that aren't important, then you have more time for what's important. And I think you have to just keep asking yourself as you make those weekly and monthly and semester priorities, you know, what's really important here?
Yeah, that's the question to ask. What's really most important right now? And John, did you ever read the book Essentialism?
No, I didn't. Tell me about it.
What you're saying there really reminds me of the author's idea of that everything obviously isn't important. And he separates things into two sections. You either have the vital few of what you need to focus on, or the trivial many, which most people and ineffective people focus on trying to get everything done. And that's essentially the idea of the book. He digs into different exercises you can participate in to identify your vital few and avoid the trivial many. But that's the key component of it. It's a call to live more simply, a call to establish your priorities and make sure you're working towards those as opposed to everything else. And the author firmly believes if you don't set an agenda for your work, for your life, then somebody else will. They'll set the agenda for you. And most likely you're not going to be happy with the end product.
I would agree with that. I think for educators, probably one of the sticking points on that, at least, and I'm speaking from my own experience, is that because educators tend to really be relationship focused and believe in people and, you know, care about people, focusing on the crucial things can make you seem brusque and uninterested to people. So somehow you have to balance, you know, good social interactional skills with hard-nosed decisions about what you're going to spend your time on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Teachers, it's interesting because in your model, you're talking about the need for effective feedback, right? And you shared the book, The Culture of Critique, which explores that. I think you mentioned it was written by Ryan Berger. And the interesting thing in my experience with teachers is they like to play nice, right? And they don't necessarily give the feedback necessary to move things forward. And I'm wondering if you have any insights and how to toe the line there between that delicate balance of establishing and maintaining incredible relationships while speaking the truth when it may sometimes hurt.
I wish I did, Daniel.
Me too.
And on the list of interview questions that I looked at before, possible interview questions I looked at before we talked, you know, one of them was what is your greatest failure as a leader? And I think it's along those lines. I mean, I think it's really hard. It requires learning how to do it. And I certainly didn't have that experience, and I don't think most educators do, of maintaining the positive, caring relationship and yet being frank and pointing out places where people are not living up to the expectations you had, and a need to, you know, perhaps recalibrate those expectations, or perhaps finding ways in which people can live up to those expectations.
There's a fantastic resource, a book called Crucial Conversations. Have you ever read that by any chance?
I have heard of it, but I have not read it. My wife has read it.
Maybe she's applied that to your relationship, too. It's possible.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah, that's a really great text, and I encourage all the school leaders to check that out. It's made by a company called Vital Smarts, but they really explore how do you have those difficult conversations when the stakes are high, but the relationship is very meaningful to you, and you want to maintain a great relationship. So that's crucial conversations. John, how do you want to be remembered as a school leader?
That's quite a question. Well, first of all, I think it's more important that project-based learning expand and be accepted as a legitimate and respected instructional approach. That, to me, is most important. There are a lot of people interested in project-based learning, but if you, tote it up all of the time students spend in projects, it's not all that much. And there, most teachers are certainly not predominantly project-based learning teachers. They might do a project now and then. It's not seen as a way to organize most schools or most classrooms. So I think there's a lot of room for expansion and creating high-quality experiences for students through projects. That would be most important to me. I think looking a little more ego-focused on myself, I would hope that some of the research syntheses and putting together of what other people have found out, both through research and through their own personal clinical experience, making that accessible to teachers, school leaders. You know, if I could be seen somehow as a synthesizer or an organizer, something like that, that would be very meaningful.
Besides watching the World Cup every 4 years, what do you do for fun?
I love hiking. I mentioned my wife. My wife and I like to go on hiking vacations. We're going to Spain in March and hiking for 10 days on the Camino, the famous pilgrimage that goes to Santiago de Compostela. We've walked in England. We do quite a bit of hiking here in California. We live very close to a natural area, take the dog out, and go walking for 3 or 4 hours. So I would say getting out of doors and hiking is probably one of the most enjoyable things I do.
Well, John, you've made it to the last question. This is quite a challenging question, but I'm really interested in how you will answer it. You're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by budget. Your only limitation is your very powerful imagination. How would you create the school if you were given a blank slate and unlimited resources? What would be your top three priorities building this school?
Well, first of all, I would delegate all practical issues to someone else. That is the architecture, the site, the lighting, all of that, because I don't know much about that. What I would emphasize myself is culture building. And if it's a new school, then one will be hiring new staff, and that is just a tremendous gift to a principal to either reconstitute a school or to start from scratch and have people who say, I want to be there and I want to implement and actualize the vision you have, in this case, the vision of project-based learning. But you still have to meld them together into a team, and that would require conversations, retreats, shared experience, working toward a goal, just a lot of discussion, team building, culture building. That would be the most important thing for me. Next, I would like to, as a team, look at the curriculum and talk about where we are going to do something really excellent. I understand the need to follow a general curriculum, but if each school had one area of excellence, maybe it's mathematics, maybe it's theater arts, maybe it's athletics, maybe it's band. But within, the normal specifications of what students do, what's going to be really excellent? And how are we going to define excellence? And how are we going to make sure that students have the opportunity to learn how to be excellent? So it's not just saying we're going to have a gifted and talented program that has a lot of, math Olympiad or something like that, some competition where you go compete against other schools. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But is that what excellence in math is? Let's define what we need. Maybe we have excellence But we don't have, if it's a secondary school, calculus. You know, maybe we just have kids that really understand it. So that would be probably the second thing. And then the third thing I would focus on is parent and community. And I would try and engage them with the vision. I would hopefully have a year before the school opened to do outreach and communication and to explain what's going on and why this school is going to be different and how it's going to be excellent and what they can do and why they would want to do it, and build a strong layer of community and parent support.
John, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Probably the best way to get a hold of me is to email me, John, J-O-H-N, at BIE.org. And in terms of advice, I guess the key takeaway would be start small, iterate, get better.
Start small, iterate, and get better. Wise words for the Better Leaders, Better Schools listeners. Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and John. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type John in the search bar, and the show notes page will pop up where you'll get highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. On most mobile phones, you could tap on the cover art and the show notes page will magically appear. John, thank you for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you, Daniel, for the opportunity.
Hey, Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Do you want to be awesome? I know you do. Please leave a 5-star rating and review for us. Click the podcast artwork and long press the show some love link. That'll bring up a page where you can leave a review. This helps the show stay relevant in iTunes and reach a wider audience that wants to become a better leader. If you'd like to connect with me, and I would love to connect with you, there are also links in the show notes. The blog and podcast has an audience in over 100 countries. Connect with me via email, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or the website betterleadersbetterschools.com.